Welcome to Black Hawk Church. My name is Chris. I'm one of the pastors on staff at Black Hawk. If you are a regular Black Hawk attender, I want to ask you a question. Have you ever heard this phrase? The Bible is written to us, not everybody's correcting me. The Bible is written not to us, but it's written. Boy, I just messed that up, didn't I? So let's do that phrase again. The Bible is not written to us, but it's written. So how many of you heard us say that before? Raise your hand. Raise your hand real big. Okay. So that phrase is not my phrase. I got it from the guy who's speaking tonight. And I messed it up right in front of him. That's just the worst. That's as bad as a beginning as you could possibly have. John has been a tremendous help to me and my understanding of the Bible, not just what he's largely going to talk about tonight, but in terms of the whole Bible and an ability to try to get inside the minds and the culture of the people who actually originally first heard whatever we're reading today. So that little line, the Bible is not written to us, but for us, I know has helped many of you as it's helped me. And many of the things that John has taught over the years have helped me quite a bit. John Walton is our speaker tonight. He is a professor of Hebrew and Old Testament studies at Wheaton since 2001. Before that, he was a professor for about 20 years at the Moody Bible Institute in Chicago. John is the author of many different books, and we only have a few of the books here tonight. And let me just kind of set that up. During the break, you're welcome to go back and to the bookstore anytime tonight. This is the book that he'll be talking about a lot tonight, and it's called The Lost World of Genesis 1, and it just came out, and we do have this for sale in the Resource Center. And then we also have in the Resource Center this commentary that's published by Zondervan, and it's on Genesis, and this also from John, and we have this available also this evening. And then John is really excited about Zondervan just publishing this. This just came out. He just got his own copy within the last few days. This is the Zondervan Illustrated Bible Backgrounds Commentary. And John is the general editor on this. And this is a five-volume set, and it just came out. And so I walked in the Resource Center with John. I said, I've never seen that before. And he said, it's just because it just came out. So this work was about 7 years in the making, and it's a huge and important work. All kinds of pictures and plates and different kinds of things in here, which really makes it difficult to publish because it takes a long time to get permission to do those kind of things. So it's really fantastic. Then also, there is the Old Testament Today, which is an introduction to the Old Testament, and there is a new updated version of this also that's just come out. We have this also available. And then I brought what I think is one of my favorite books by John, and we didn't order this, but I think our life group leaders got this a couple years ago. This is called The Essential Bible Companion, and this is the one I took from the Resource Center, so I'll leave it up here, and you can grab it. I think every home should have this book because he gives a summary of every book in the Bible in at least one or two pages. And there's very few books that do that kind of thing. So you can just go to, well, what's Habakkuk about? What's Zechariah about? So you can just turn here, find it, and he gives the background and some helpful comments about what that book is. And I found this to be very, very helpful for myself and for all kinds of people that are studying the Bible. This is just should be in everybody's home. I really love this book. All right, the format tonight is going to be John's going to lecture for about 50 minutes. And the first lecture will be with regards to he's going to present his view of Genesis and his understanding of Genesis, and particularly Genesis 1, and that will be largely a lot about what his book is about. Then we'll take a 10-minute break, And I've asked him this a couple of times. He's okay with questions in the break, but be nice to him, okay? Because then he's going to come back and lecture for another 50 minutes. And that second 50 minutes will have more to do with kind of the science, that scientific questions that people might have with regards to his view and how that would affect our understanding of science. So if you could just simply divide the evening into kind of a summary. First 50 minutes, kind of the Bible, 10-minute break, second 50 minutes more about how that relates to science. And then the evening will be over. So I'm so happy that you came tonight. And why don't you welcome to the platform, John Walton.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks, Chris. It really is my great privilege to be here, and it's so great that all of you came out. Weekends are busy enough, and here you are on a Saturday night to come and have us all think together about things that are really very important to us. We really want to understand the Bible as best we can, and I imagine that's why lots of you are here, because the Bible is important to you, and maybe some are here because you'd really like to find out more about this and whether the Bible should be important to you or whether it can be dismissed. For some people, they feel like they need to dismiss the Bible or choose between the Bible and science because too many obstacles, too many barriers between them. And we'll be talking about that probably more in the second part. I have developed over the last decade or so this position on Genesis 1, which I'll be presenting tonight. It was first published in my commentary, although it's tough to find it all in one place when it's kind of scattered through a commentary. And so the Lost World book that just came out in May was designed to kind of make that accessible. And I've polished it some over the years. Of course, I've been at Black Hawk a couple times talking about it in one form or another, and maybe some of you have heard me talk about it before. My position hasn't changed any, but I find better ways to express it and clearer ways to make the points. And so I hope that even if you've heard this before, that you might benefit from this repetition of it. So, the Bible is not written to us, but it's written for us. We're really glad that it's written for us. I mean, the whole idea that God would reveal himself is an act of grace. It exceeds nearly every act of grace. I mean, God's sending his son to die for us certainly has to be at the top of the list, but right along there with it is the fact that God has chosen to communicate. And we want to understand that communication because we want to understand God. And that's where the rub is, because since it is not written to us, we have trouble penetrating that world, penetrating the text that was written to somebody else and that in many ways has a foreign feel to us. It's most natural for us to try to read it from our own world perspective. And to try to have it make sense in our own world perspective, because we want to benefit from what's there. But it's very difficult to do that, and there are plenty of places along the way where we can make mistakes. So I want to talk tonight about reading Genesis 1 from an ancient worldview. Sometimes when I do these lectures, we'll talk about it, you know, Genesis in ancient eyes, or Genesis as ancient cosmology, Genesis as the Israelites would have read it, things of that sort. And it's all getting the same place, to try to see how the original audience would have heard it and what they would have thought. Lots of times when we talk about interpreting the Bible, we talk about our intention and our commitment to read it literally. And literally maybe not isn't always the best word to use, but the idea that we really want to get from it what it's trying to give. After all, we don't want to squeeze it into our own desires, and then it's not working as God's word anymore. We want to get what it intends to give, and that's what we generally mean when we say we want to read it literally. We don't want to make it into something else or twist it around or kind of dodge what it's trying to do. And the best way for us to read the text literally is to read it through the eyes of the ancient world, the author, the audience, the Israelites, and try to understand that world. How do we get to that world? You know, the whole attempt to say, okay, you've persuaded me. I need to do this. I really want to do this. How do we get there? The only way we have to get there is through the literature of the ancient world. It's the only window we have. I mean, this is a building with only one window, and that's the one we have to look through. That creates some discomfort in people because lots of that literature is the mythology of the ancient world, with gods that we put no stock in and give no credit to, with beliefs that are abhorrent to us, with ideas that would shock us, and we feel kind of, boy, I don't know about trying to understand the Bible by getting into this mythology. Remember, the point is not to bring mythology across and bring mythology's ideas. The idea is that whether it's mythology or other literature, to read it to get a view to what their culture is all about. You know, when I was raising my kids, they're older now, they're all in their 20s, but when I was raising my kids, one of the things that I always wanted to do was read the stuff they were reading. I wanted to read the books, whether they had to read them in school or whether they just wanted to read those things. That's what I wanted to do, because I wanted to try to get a view into the things that they were taking in, the things that were part of their world. And that was a way I could try to understand them better and interact with them. That's the same kind of thing we're doing here. We've got some witnesses to what the ancient world was all about. And those witnesses have spoken in the literature. And so when I read the mythology of ancient Babylon or Canaan or Egypt, it's not because I think the Bible is mythology. It's because this is the way I enter into that ancient world and learn how to try to think a little bit the way they think. We'll always have barriers, but that's how we make the attempt. Now, when we approach Genesis 1 then, we're going to find that there are some things that will surprise us, that were very evident, transparent, intuitive to the ancient reader, that aren't that way to us at all. The biggest one, I'm going to start here. We get to the seventh day. You say, wait a minute, I want to talk about the other. Well, we'll get there, okay? But let's start with the seventh day. The seventh day, when the text says that God rested, everyone in the ancient world, Israelite, Canaanite, Babylonian, Egyptian, everyone in the ancient world would have an immediate reaction. Oh, this is about the temple. And we say, what planet are you from? Planet Babylon, you know. They would immediately have that response. Why would they have that response? Well, they would have that response because in the ancient world, God's rest in temples. In the Bible, God rests in the temple. The texts are there. This is something that's common throughout the ancient world. This isn't a piece of mythology. This is how everybody thought in the ancient world, that God's rest in temples. Furthermore, temples were built for the explicit purpose of God resting in it. And so when they read God resting, there's no other place that could possibly be. This is a temple. Now, that immediately adds a dynamic, a dimension to the text that we would be clueless. We would never pick that up. And we might say, well, if the temple, why didn't they say so? They did. They said God rested. That's as much as they needed to say. Now, as a result, when Moses gives this text to the Israelites and talks about God resting, he knows they understand that. Remember, it's to them, not to us. If he were talking to us, he'd have to explain that. But to his audience, he didn't have to explain that. They understood that perfectly well. Now, as soon as we start thinking that this is a temple, then we have these other questions. Well, we would ask, what does it mean that God's resting? We usually think of resting, you know, kind of relaxing, leisure time, maybe a Sunday afternoon snooze, a Sunday paper, football game, resting, you know, resting. Not them. No, that's not what they mean by this. Now, again, you would know that by reading other portions of the Bible, well, Old Testament or New Testament. That's the part back by the maps. Okay. The Old Testament or New Testament both have this concept of God talking about rest. When he talks about it for Israel, he's going to give them rest from their enemies all around. Is he really saying he's going to give them leisure time? Relaxation opportunities? Oh, of course not. When Hebrews 4 talks about you've not yet entered that rest, but you know that rest is something that Christ is providing. No, it's not relaxation and leisure. What's going on? What's this rest all about? When we look at those texts and understand the dynamics of the theology and the covenant and God's work on behalf of his people, it's really not hard to understand. When they were struggling with all of their enemies, when they're struggling in Hebrews with persecution, when they're struggling with all of the things that the world throws at them, life can get kind of hectic and tense and stressful and lots of disturbances and chaos and anarchy. And God says, I can resolve that. I can take care of that. I will give you rest. And that rest is not the opportunity for leisure. It's the opportunity to live your life without all the mess that goes on. You ever moved? You know, everything's in boxes, and you got all kinds of things you have to do, and address to change, and utilities to talk to. Oh, my goodness, so many things to do. I can't even get on with life because all of this stuff to do. That's the idea, that chaos, disruption, disturbance. And that's going to get resolved. You finally get everything unpacked, all the errands done, all the to-do list checked off, and everything's set, and now you can rest. Again, not necessarily meaning relax. Now you can get back to life and do the things that you want to do. If it seems like I'm over-laboring this issue, it's because we so easily misunderstand it. This rest, then, has to do with the disturbances being set aside, taken care of. Everything's been brought into order so that the regular tasks can be carried out. That's why God rests in a temple. God rests in a temple not to relax or have leisure, but to run this world, because that's what the temple is. It's the control room of the cosmos. When we have the presidential elections, these folks work for 2 years to rest in the White House. And that's not kicking up their feet and snoozing on the Lincoln bedroom, okay? It means I'm going into that Oval Office and I'm in charge. We find that in the Old Testament, God's rest in his temple is connected to his control, his reign. Let me read it to you in case you just have doubts, you know, and wonder where I'm getting that. In Psalm 132, starting in verse 10, it's talking about David, the anointed one. The Lord swore an oath to him. And then in verse 13, for the Lord has chosen Zion. He has desired it for his dwelling. Okay, there's the temple in Jerusalem, Zion for his dwelling, saying, this is my resting place forever and ever. Again, not comatose, okay, resting forever, okay, but my resting place forever and ever, he explains it. Here I will sit enthroned, for I have desired it. Temple, rest, rule. The three go together. Throughout the ancient world, the three go together. And the temple reflects then the fact that God has brought order to the world and he's ready to run it. So often in the ancient mythologies, you get the connection between cosmology, creation, and temple building. They're very closely related because the God who did the creating is the God who's going to establish a temple, a control room for himself, and the God who's going to reign and rule. These are connected issues. So for the Bible and for the ancient world, rest is in a temple, and rest communicates the idea of God's rule, his reign. Now, that gives us a different perspective on what this text is. This is a temple text. What does it mean that it's a temple text? Well, another thing that you need to know about temples in the ancient world is that temples are considered to be a microcosmos, a little model of the cosmos that's kind of containing what goes on, symbolizing it. It's kind of connected to the whole cosmic idea. The temple on earth was believed to be connected, almost umbilical cord-like, to the temple in heaven where the God dwelt. And that was the place of God's reign and rule, and the two were kind of connected. So this is where heaven and earth meet, in the temple. That's why people couldn't go in there, okay? This is God's dwelling place, and it's like entering into heaven when you enter there, because that's God's place. And so this idea of the connection between the temple and the cosmos, and the cosmos and the temple, in all of the design of the temple, you can see these elements, and that they're emphasized architecturally and in terms of the decor, all of it very much cosmic orientation. And again, you could do a whole study on that, and people have done it, and it's published out there. So this idea that there is an association between the cosmos and the temple leads us to the next step, that not only is this a temple text, but it's a text that is configuring the cosmos as a temple. In other words, this is the establishment of God's cosmic temple. And so, obviously, then, at the end of this establishment of his cosmic temple, he takes up his rest in it, because it's not a temple until God's in it. Now, when we start thinking about cosmic temple and God's rest in this cosmic temple, his control and his reign and his rule, the next step we have to start getting to is, okay, so how do we think then about a temple text? How did temple texts work in the ancient world? If this is one, then I should understand more about them. And how did they work in the ancient world so that I might understand it better? Well, for the ancient world, the idea of a temple text was that this is going to function in certain ways. It's going to function so that the world is maintained. Now, in the ancient world as a whole, they lived in a frame of mind that I call the great symbiosis. The great symbiosis is that the gods have needs, and that's how people portrayed them. Not in Israel, of course, when they were thinking straight, at least. But the gods have needs, and the gods were kind of tired at one point of meeting their own needs, and so they decided that some slave labor would be good. So they created people. And people were created to serve the needs of the gods. And so that took place so that people then serve the gods' needs, and the gods in return will meet the needs of people. That's the great symbiosis, kind of a codependency that exists in the universe with each one meeting the needs of the other. All of that took place in the context of the temple, because that was where the image of the god was. That's where the sacrifices were made that were the food of the god. The temple was his housing, and the image was clothed very richly, and all of these things, music played and beautiful smells and scents, all of this to make it a very nice place for the deity, so the deity would then bless them. That's the great symbiosis in the ancient world. And of course, for Israel, no, that's not how it works. Okay, you remember places like Psalm 50. I own the cattle on 1,000 hills. We remember that part from the song. The next part's not in the song. If I were hungry, I wouldn't ask you. Okay, I'm full, thanks. The idea that God has needs is not part of this. So we're going to get a different perspective about the temple and the cosmos in an Israelite piece. Again, remember that God is addressing Israel in her world, in the way that they tended to think about things. And so this whole idea of how is God revealing himself to show his association with this world that he created. And so we have a lot of discussion about the functions of the temple, and I'll get to that in a moment. When we talk about the creation text, we tend to do it in terms of the way we think in our world. We tend to be very materialistic in the way that we think about things. And so science, we know, deals with a lot of the physical, material world, how it works, what makes it work, things that we can understand because of the way that it works that way. And that's sort of the scientific enterprise. And the popularity of the scientific enterprise, the value and the merit granted to the scientific enterprise have all made us even increasingly materialistic in our thinking. And that's fine. I'm not trying to criticize that. That's how our world is, and there's a lot of benefit to that. But it would be a mistake for us to think that they thought in the same ways in the ancient world. Why should they think in those ways? They don't have the same kind of scientific ways of thinking that we do. They don't have near the emphasis on the material world as we do. They're going to think in other terms. You know, even today, you wouldn't think of going to sort of an isolated place in the world that's still fairly primitive and trying to conduct a lecture on cell biology. You know, that just wouldn't be productive at all. They're not thinking in any terms remotely close to that. And it'd be the same in the biblical world. We shouldn't expect them to think about the world the same way we think about the world. And so we have to start asking questions. How did they think about the world? Now, again, when God communicated, he's not communicating in some kind of Unicode language that everybody of all times and all places will understand. That's not a possibility, even for God. I hate to say something's impossible for God, but the fact is if you express it in one term, you can't express it in another term. Okay, you have to make a choice. And so if God is going to frame his revelation in scientific terms, we've got to ask the question, who's science? I mean, why in the world should we choose the science of the 21st century and say, that's the one God ought to communicate in? That wouldn't have made any sense to people back in the 19th century or the 16th century, and certainly not any sense to the people in ancient Israel who he was communicating to. Likewise, people in the 22nd century would look and say, that's stupid. We don't think anything like that anymore, because we know science changes. And so if we ask the question, whose science is going to give the framework for communication? Again, God is not revealing science. He's using scientific information as a framework for communication. Whose is it? Well, it's going to be theirs. That's who he chose to communicate to. And he's going to use their science. He's not revealing science, but you can't avoid certain assumptions when you talk about something like creation, and he's going to use their assumptions. That's not a problem for us, because we understand that all communication requires accommodation. You know, when I get up in front of a group like this, I'm not really sure who I'm talking to. Do I have a lot of scientists here? Do I have theologians here? Do I have people who are not believing and are curious? Do I have people who are really believe very firmly? Do I have people who have already done a lot of reading? I don't know. So I have to kind of use general communication. I can't tailor it. If I'm talking to a class of sixth graders, I know who I've got there. I know how to address that group, and I have to accommodate my speech, my vocabulary, the ideas I use, because they're the ones that need to understand it. Communication always requires accommodation to the audience as best as you understand it. So when God spoke to the Israelites, he accommodated their culture, their language. We know that. It's in Hebrew. It has to be translated. He accommodated their ideas as the framework for his communication. No surprise, there really aren't a lot of choices about that. That's how communication works, if it's going to be effective. And so he doesn't give them any new science, not a single bit of new science. Everything in biblical revelation is stuff that the Israelites could have understood. It fit into their world. And there's nothing that's different from that. So when he talked about the where the thinking processes took place, he talks about thinking with your heart, because that's what they believed in the ancient world. When God talks to the Israelites about thinking with their hearts or feeling with their hearts or whatever they do with their hearts besides pumping blood, he's accommodating to their worldview. He's not revealing physiology and anatomy. He's using as a framework their understanding of physiology and anatomy. And that's okay. There aren't a lot of choices here. Okay, so he's using how they believe. And so when your biblical texts say with all your heart and soul and mind, your translator's helping you there. The word that they're translating, mind, entrails. Okay? But see, they're accommodating you, because that wouldn't mean anything to you if they put entrails there. Okay? So even there's some accommodation. But God's talking about entrails and heart, and because that's where people in the ancient world, including the Israelites, believed the thinking processes took place. Not a problem for God to do that. That doesn't jeopardize the authority of the biblical text. It's not a problem with the inerrancy, because inerrancy focuses on what the text is affirming, and the text is not affirming a physiology. It's merely using that as a framework to talk to them. Because whatever you think with, even if it's your big toenail, think godly thoughts. That's the point. What's important is what you think, not what you use to think. And we could point out examples all through the biblical text of this kind of accommodation. And it's not a problem. It shouldn't be a problem. It can't be a problem. And so also, as God talks about creation, he accommodates their way of thinking. He plugs into their worldview, what I like to call their cognitive environment, because I'm a professor, so I try to use long words. And so that idea of, you know, how they're thinking, he's going to be an effective communicator. He's going to shoot for the stuff that's important. Now, in the ancient world, as I began to say a few moments ago, they didn't necessarily think very, very much in material terms. It's not that they're unaware of the material world around them. Of course they are. They could stub their toe just as easily as you can walking around in the dark. Okay, but they understand material things, but it's just not very important to them. If you got a new computer and I said, well, tell me about your new computer. There's all kinds of things you would tell me, but probably really almost last on the list would be a discussion of where the tower was manufactured. Why? Well, because you know that's really not very important to you, and it's not very important to me, and that wouldn't be something to talk about unless you're a tower manufacturer, sorry. That wouldn't be on the top of your list to talk about. No, because there's something more important than kind of those material kinds of issues. So even for us today, we often would throw our emphasis somewhere else. But of course, when we talk about the origins of the world, we tend to ask those questions in a material context because, again, that's who we are. In the ancient world, it was much more important for them to understand the functional perspective. By functional perspective, I mean that they wanted to know how something worked. When you go to a new job, you probably won't ask a whole lot of questions about the architect who designed the building or the articles of incorporation and the law firm that put those together and how long the company has existed and this. I mean, they would be mild curiosities if that. What you really want to know is, who do I report to? Who gives me orders? Who signs my paycheck? Who does my quarterly reviews? You want to know how things work, because that's going to dictate all of the aspects of your job. Function's important. And in the ancient world, it's really what is most important. And in fact, when they talk about origins in the ancient world, they're really not very interested in material origins. They're interested in functional origins. How did this place get going so it works? How is it organized? Who's in charge? Okay, this idea of functions and how they fit together. Those are the questions they have. Material origins are just not important to them at all. And I would suggest to you that the Bible has that same perspective. And I think there are evidences to demonstrate that. That the Bible is much more interested in functions and the origins of functions than it is in that which is material and the origins of material. Now, again, this doesn't mean that they didn't think God was responsible for the material cosmos. Of course he was. They don't think that matter is eternal or something like that. Okay, they believe, I mean, if you could back an Israelite into a corner and try to get them to think in material terms, way beyond what they would be inclined to do, sure, God, you know, nothing happens without God in the ancient world. Remember that in the ancient world, there's no divide between natural and supernatural. God's doing everything. God's involved in everything. They don't have anything like natural laws. They don't even talk about miracles. Because to call some things miracles would assume that God wasn't involved in other things. They don't believe that. They talk about signs and wonders, God's demonstrations of his power, God's doing of really incredible things, signs and wonders, but not miracles. They wouldn't talk about intervening. God doesn't intervene. He's doing it all the time. What's there to intervene? So they would see God involved all the time. So there's no supernatural, natural divide for them to be concerned about. So certainly everything that happened, God did it. It was in their theology. It's in my theology. But having said that, as sort of a caveat or disclaimer perhaps, when we ask the question, fine, but what is the Genesis 1 account about? What's this part of the story? My answer to that, my proposal, is that this part of the story is about functional origins and how God got the cosmos functioning. And when I talk about functioning, again, we can't think scientific functioning or ecological functioning or things like that. That's not their way of thinking. When they talk about functioning, they want to know, not functioning for God. That's how the rest of the ancient Near East would have written it, because the gods made the worlds for themselves. And people were just the slave labor. But in Israel, that's not the case. In Israel, God made the world for people. People in his image. People that he cared about and wanted to have a relationship with. That's who he made the world for. And it doesn't function for him. He doesn't need it. It functions for them. And so when I'm talking about a functional account, I'm talking about an account that says, how will this world work for people? So the sun is not a burning ball of gas. It's rather for signs, seasons, days, and years. The people stuff. That's what it's for. And that's what they care about. And that's how God talks about it. He kind of leaves the burning ball of gas stuff off for later on for people to figure out. Okay, and so they believed that the sun and the moon and the stars and the birds were all, and the clouds were all in the same spot. Ooh, that bird got the sun. Oh man, that got hurt. They thought they were all in the same realm. And God didn't have to tell them any different than that. That was okay. They'll be okay. God makes the world work. And so this functional orientation, for them, that is creation. That's what it meant for God to create in the ancient world, to give functions. In the other ancient literature that we read on creation texts, we find the language of creation includes a number of different kinds of verbs. Verbs like separating, naming, assigning roles. Sound familiar? Because that's what we have in Genesis as well. Those are creative activities in the ancient world because they are all tied up with giving these functions. And when we look at the verb create in Genesis 1, God created heavens and earth. We start looking around on that verb and how it's used in Hebrew texts. Again, if you're going to talk literal, you know, we want to interpret the text literally. So create, it means create. Great. What's that mean? Well, you've got to look at Hebrew text. You've got to look at the Hebrew word. I'm not trying to pull an elitist move on you here. Okay, but the fact is that's what's involved in it. And you can do that work as easily as anybody who knows their Hebrew. You get out a concordance and you look at all the places where this word is used and take a look at how it's used. What's most important is that you look at the objects, the direct objects. When it says God, God's always a subject. God created X. Okay, what are those X that you fill in? Because that's going to tell you what kind of work creating is. And you find all kinds of unusual things. God creates purity. God creates darkness. God creates the nations. God creates Jerusalem. All kinds of things that it's not about material. And you say, oh, so creation, that word, is not particularly a material activity. It's a functional activity. Now, I wouldn't change the word in your translations because the fact is in English we use the verb create in similar ways. We'll talk about people creating a curriculum or creating a committee or creating a masterpiece, or in the case of your kids, creating havoc. The idea that we have all kinds of functional, organizational things that we use the word create for. It's a good word. I'll keep it. But the idea that when God created heavens and earth, that is a functional activity in this account. Again, I've got no problem with the material thing eventually. I better talk about that right away as I see our time slipping away on this first part. When they build a temple, okay, this is a temple text. God's going to rest at the end of it. That's really important, okay? God's going to rest at the end of it, okay? So it's temple text. When they built temples, so let's learn something here. What'd they do? Well, Solomon builds his temple. They spend 7 years, 7 years doing what I would call the material phase. They're acquiring the stone, they're mining the gold, they're building the furniture, they're doing all the woodwork, they're doing all of the sewing for the vestments and the veil. There are plenty of material things to do. It all has to be done. They get that all done, material phase complete. And we find out that, of course, that's only preparatory. Because all the material phase is done, there it sits in front of you. Is it a temple? No, it is not a temple. Because it's not functioning as one. And God's not in it. And there are no priests offering sacrifices. That is not a temple. But all the preparation's done. Then they spend some time, usually 7 days, getting ready for the functional operation of this temple. And they talk about the functions of the temple. How's this going to work? What's it going to do? You can read some of this in Solomon's dedicatory prayer. What's this temple going to be like? What's it going to accomplish? How's it going to function? They install the functionaries, get everybody in place so it's all ready to go. And God comes and he rests in his temple, and now it's a temple. And the temple has therefore been created. Now, the material phase was necessary. You couldn't have it without that. But the real creation of the temple is in that functional phase. That was most important. And so in Genesis, when it talks about the creation of the cosmic temple, it does the same thing. It talks about the functions. And the first 3 days are about functions. The first day isn't about light, because he says he called the light day. And the darkness he called night. It's about day and night. Light for them was not a material thing. It may be for us, but it wasn't for them. Are we going to read the text in their eyes or not? Darkness is not a material thing. And the darkness and light, the periods of darkness and light, he named day and night. And so on day one, God created time. And on day two, God created the basis for weather. It talks about this rakia, the expanse, the firmament that God put up there. Well, that's how they thought in the ancient world, so he uses that kind of language. That's his framework for communication. But that's the basis on which weather happens. Okay, and we'll talk about that a little bit more in the second part. So day two is weather. Day three, we have the dry land emerging. We have the waters. We have the sprouting forth of plants. You know, there, God's not making anything, but it's a very important step in the functional creation because that's where we get food. So day one, God created time. Day two, God created weather. Day three, God created food. And now you can see that on this point at least, God is able to communicate to everyone. Because no matter what time period you live in, what section of the world you live in, whatever way you think, time, weather, and food, that's our lives. And God makes it work. God set it up to work, and it works. He's the one in charge. He's the one who reigns. And that addresses everybody. Days 4, 5, and 6, I propose, are involved with the functionaries. Sometimes people get worried. How come we have light on day one, and we have sun, moon, and stars on day 4? We have a couple shaky days there. You know, how do we work all of that out? And if you're old Earth and have long periods of time with each day, you start worrying about photosynthesis on day 3 when you don't have the sun till day 4. And panic. Okay, we don't have to worry about all of this. Okay, this is a temple text. It's an account of the functions, 3 main functions, time, weather, food. Then it can get talking about the functionaries. This isn't a sequence of material things. Okay, but the functionaries then. The functionaries connected with the sphere of time. Well, that's sun, moon, and stars. The functionaries involved in the sky and the seas, well, that's the birds and the fish. The functionaries involved in the food and the dry land, well, that's people. And you'll notice that at every turn, it's a functional discussion. People are created in the image of God, subdue and rule. Here's food for you. Functional discussion. That's what's important to them. My proposal then is that Genesis 1 is not an account of material origins. It's an account of functional origins. That is undergirded and supported by the ancient way of thinking, number one. The biblical text, number two, and not in that priority order. And a firm, strong, vibrant, robust theology. Because when we think in material terms, it's like, yeah, God created and bye, who knows where he is. He created, kind of kicked it all off, started it going, and who knows what he's doing now. It can shove us easily toward deism. This functional orientation says he rested in his cosmic temple and he's there in the control room running it. What did he do on day 8? He ran the cosmos. What did he do on day 9? He ran the cosmos. What did he do on day... Never mind. Okay, you got the idea. Okay? That's what he set it up to do. To run the cosmos. And so we have this idea then of a functional account with a firm theology that tells us God is involved and God's at the helm and God is doing what needs to be done. We better stop there. Why don't you all take a break? And again, I'll come down here and answer a few questions if you'd like, and then we'll get to the second part of it.